that's all.
Miss Celia smiles, doesn't notice I've stretched my pie crust to where 5 holes ripped through. Just 24 more days of this shit. I'm praying to the Lord and the devil on the side that Mr. Johnny doesn't come home before then. Every other day, I hear Miss Celia on the phone in her room calling and calling the society ladies. The benefit was 3 weeks ago, and here she is already gunning up for next year. She and Mr. Johnny didn't go, or I would have heard plenty about it. I didn't work the benefit this year. First time in a decade. The money's pretty good, but I just couldn't risk running into Miss Hilly.
Could you tell her Celia Foote called again? I left her a message a few days back.
Miss Celia's voice is chipper, like she's peddling something on the TV. Every time I hear it, I want to jerk the phone out of her hand, tell her to quit wasting her time. Because never mind, she looks like a hussy. There's a bigger reason why Miss Celia doesn't have any friends, and I knew it the minute I saw that picture of Mr. Johnny. I've served enough bridge club luncheons to know something about every white woman in this town. Mr. Johnny dumped Miss Healy for Miss Celia back in college, and Miss Healy never got over him. I walk in the church on Wednesday night. It's not but half full since it's only 6:45, and the choir doesn't start singing until 7:30. But Abilene asked me to come early, so here I am. I'm curious what she has to say. Plus, Leroy was in a good mood and playing with the kids, so I figure if he wants them, he can have them. I see Abilene in our usual pew, left side, fourth from the front, right by the window fan. We're prime members, and we deserve a prime spot. She's got her hair smoothed back, a little roll of pencil curls around her neck. She's wearing a blue dress with big white buttons that I've never seen before. Abilene has white lady clothes out the wazoo. White ladies love giving her their old stuff. As usual, she looks plump and respectable. But for all her prim and proper, Abilene can still tell a dirty joke that'll make you tinkle in your pants. I walk up the aisle, see Abilene frown at something, creasing her forehead. For a second, I can see the 15-odd years between us. But then she smiles, and her face goes young and fat again. Lord, I say as soon as I'm settled in. I know, somebody gotta tell her. Abilene fans her face with a hanky. It was Kiki Brown's morning for cleaning, and the whole church is gauded up with her lemon smell good she makes and tries to sell for 25 cents a bottle. We have a sign-up sheet for cleaning the church. Ask me, Kiki Brown ought to sign a little less, and the men ought to sign a lot more. Far as I know, no man has signed that sheet once. Besides the smell, the church looks pretty good. Kiki shined the pews to where you could pick your teeth looking at them. The Christmas tree's already up next to the altar, full of tinsel and a shiny gold star on top. 3 windows of the church have stained glass, the birth of Christ, Lazarus raised from the dead, and the teaching of those fool Pharisees. The other 7 are filled with regular clear panes. We're still raising money for those. How's Benny asthma? Abilene asked. Had a little spell yesterday. Leroy dropping him and the rest of the kids by in a while. Let's hope the lemon don't kill him. Leroy. Abilene shakes her head and laughs. Tell him I said he better behave or I'm going to put him on my prayer list. I wish you would. Oh, Lord, hide the food. Hoity-toity Petrina Bessemer waddles toward us. She leans over the pew in front of us, smiling with a big, tacky blue bird on her hat. Petrina, she's the one who called Abilene a fool for all those years.
Manny, Petrina says, I sure was glad to hear about your new job.
Thank you, Petrina.
And Abilene, thank you for putting me on your prayer list. My angina sure is better now. I'll call you this weekend and we catch up.
Abilene smiles, nods. Petrina waddles off to her pew. Maybe you ought to be a little pickier who you pray for, I say. Aw, I ain't mad at her no more, says Abilene. And look at her, she done lost some weight. She telling everybody she lost 40 pounds, I say. Lord of mercy, only got 200 more to go. Abilene tries not to smile, act like she's waving away the lemon smell. So, what you want me to come early for, I ask. You miss me or something?
No, it's no big deal. Just something somebody said.
What? Abilene takes a breath, looks around for anybody listening. We're like royalty here. Folks are always hemming in on us. You know that Miss Skeeter, she asks. I told you I did the other day. She quiets her voice, says, well, remember how I slipped up and told her about Trilo writing color things down? I remember. She want to sue you for that? No, she nice. But she had the gall to ask if me and some of my maid friends might want to put down on paper what it's like to tend for white people. Say she writing a book. Say what? Abilene nods, raises her eyebrows. Mm-hmm. Well, you tell her it's a real 4th of July picnic. It's what we dream of doing all weekend. Get back in their houses to polish their silver, I say. I told her, let the regular old history books tell it. White people been representing colored opinions since the beginning of time. That's right, you tell her. I did. I told her she crazy, Abilene says. I ask her, what if we told the truth? How we too scared to ask for minimum wage? How nobody gets paid their Social Security? How it feel when your own boss be calling you? Abilene shakes her head. I'm glad she doesn't say it. How we love they kids when they little, she says. And I see Abilene's lip tremble a bit. And then they turn out just like they mamas. I look down and see Abilene gripping her black pocketbook like it's the only thing she has left in the world. Abilene, she moves on to another job when the babies get too old and stop being colorblind. We don't talk about it. Even if she is changing all the names of the help and the white ladies, she sniffed. She crazy if she think we're going to do something dangerous as that for her. We don't want to bring all that mess up. Abilene wipes her nose with a hanky. Tell people the truth? No, we don't, I say. But I stop. It's something about that word, truth. I've been trying to tell white women the truth about working for them since I was 14 years old. We don't want to change nothing around here, Abilene says. And we're both quiet, thinking about all the things we don't want to change. But then Abilene narrows her eyes at me and asks, what? You don't think it's a crazy idea? I do. And that's when I see it. We've been friends for 16 years since the day I moved from Greenwood to Jackson, and we met at the bus stop. I can read Abilene like the Sunday paper. You thinking about it, ain't you? I say. You want to talk to Miss Skeeter? She shrugs, and I know I'm right. But before Abilene can confess, Reverend Johnson comes up and sits down in the pew behind us, leans between our shoulders. Minnie, I'm sorry I haven't had the chance to tell you congratulations on your new job. I smooth my dress down. Why, thank you, Reverend Minister. You must be on Abilene's prayer list, he said, patting Abilene on the shoulder. Sure was. I told Abilene at this rate she needs to start charging. The Reverend laughs. He gets up and treads slowly to the pulpit. Everything goes still. I can't believe Abilene wants to tell Miss Skeeter the truth. Truth. It feels cool, like water washing over my sticky hot body, cool in a heat that's been burning me up all my life. Truth, I say inside my head again, just for that feeling. Reverend Johnson raises his hand and speaks in a soft, deep voice. The choir behind him begins to hum, talking to Jesus, and we all stand up. In a half minute, I'm sweating. Think you might be interested in talking to Miss Skeeter, whispers Abilene. I look back, and there's Leroy with the kids, late as usual. Who, me? I say, and my voice is loud against the soft music. I tamp it down, but not by much. Ain't no way I'm gonna do something crazy as that. For no reason but to irritate me, we get a heat wave in December. In 40 degrees, I sweat like iced tea in August, and here I woke up this morning to 83 on the dial. I've spent half my life trying not to sweat so much. Dainty lady sweat cream, frozen potatoes in my pocket, ice pack tied to my head. I actually paid a doctor for that fool advice. and I still soaked my sweatpants through in 5 minutes. I tote my Fairly Funeral Home fan every place I go. Works good, and it was free. Miss Celia takes to the week of warm weather, though, and actually goes outside and sits by the pool in this tacky white sunglasses and a fuzzy bathrobe. Thank the Lord she's out of the house. At first I thought maybe she was sick in the body, but now I'm wondering if she's sick in the head. I don't mean the talking to yourself variety you see in the old ladies like Miss Walters, where you know it's just the old-timer's disease, but the capital C crazy, where you get hauled to Whitfield in a straitjacket. I catch her slipping upstairs to the empty bedrooms almost every day now. I hear her sneaky little feet walking down the hall, passing over that little squeak in the floor. I don't think much of it. Heck, it's her house. But then one day, she does it again, and then again, and it's the fact that she's so darn sneaky about it, waiting until I turn on the Hoover or get busy on the cake that makes me suspicious. She spends about 7 or 8 minutes up there and then pokes her little head around to make sure I don't see her come down again. "Don't go getting in her business," Leroy says. "You just make sure she tell her mister you cleaning his house." Leroy's been on the damn crow the past couple of nights, drinking behind the power plant after his shift. He's no fool. He knows if I'm dead, that paycheck won't be showing up on his own. After she makes her trip upstairs, Miss Celia comes to the kitchen table instead of going back to bed. I'd wish she'd get out of here. I'm pulling chicken off the bone. I've got the broth boiling and the dumplings already cut. I don't want her trying to help with this. "Just 13 more days before you tell Mr. Johnny about me," I say. And like I knew she would, Miss Celia gets up from the kitchen table and heads for her bedroom. But before she makes it out the door, she mutters, "Do you have to remind me of that fact every day of my life?" I stand up straighter. That's the first time Miss Celia's ever gotten cross with me. "Mm-hmm," I tell her, not even looking up, because I will remind her until Mr. Johnny shook my hand and said, "Nice to meet you, Minnie." But then I look over and see Miss Celia still standing there. She's holding on to the door frame. Her face has gone flat white like cheap wall paint. "You been fooling around with the raw chicken again?"
"No, I'm just tired."
But the pricks of sweat on her makeup, that's now gone gray, tell me she's not fine. I help her to bed and bring her the Lady of Pinkham to drink. The pink label has a picture of a real proper lady on it with a turban on her head, smiling like she feels better. I hand Miss C the spoon to measure it out, but that tacky woman just drinks it straight from the bottle. Afterwards, I wash my hands. Whatever she's got, I hope it ain't catching. The day after Miss C, your face goes funny, is Change the Damn Sheets Day, and the day I hate the most. Sheets are just too personal a thing for folks who aren't kin to be fooling with. They are full of hair and scabs and snot and the signs of jelly rolling. But it's the blood stains that are the worst. Scrubbing those out with my bare hands, I gag over the sink. That goes for blood anywhere and anything with a suspicious resemblance. A stepped-on strawberry can hang me over the toilet bowl for the rest of the day. Miss Celia knows about Tuesdays, and usually she moves out to the sofa so I can do my work. A cold front started in this morning, so she can't go outside to the swimming pool, and they say the weather's going to get worse. But at 9, then 10, then 11, the bedroom door still closed. Finally, I knock. "Yes," she says. I open the door. "Morning, Miss Celia." "Hey, Minnie." "It's Tuesday." Not only is Miss Celia still in bed, she's curled up on top of those covers in her nightgown without a drop of her makeup on. "I got to get them sheets washed and ironed, and I got to get to this old shift robe you done let go dry as Texas, and then we cooking." No learning lesson today, Minnie. She isn't smiling either, like she usually does when she sees me. "You feeling bad?" "Fetch me some water, will you?"
"Yes'm."
I go in the kitchen and fill up a glass from the sink. She must be feeling bad, because she's never asked me to serve her anything before. When I walk back in the bedroom, though, Missy is not in bed, and the bathroom door's closed. Now, why has she asked me to go get her water if she's got the means to get up and go to the bathroom? At least she's out of my way. I pick up Mr. Johnny's pants off the floor, toss them on my shoulder. Ask me, this woman doesn't take enough exercise, sitting around the house all day. Oh, now, Minnie, don't go on that way. If she's sick, she's sick. You sick? I holler outside the bathroom door. I'm fine. While you're in there, I'm going to go ahead and change these sheets. No, I want you to go on, she says through the door. Go on home for the day, Minnie. I stand there and tap my foot on her yellow rug. I don't want to go on home. It's Tuesday, change the damn sheets day. If I don't do it today, that makes Wednesday, change the damn sheets day too. What Mr. Johnny going to do if he come home and this house a mess? He's at the deer camp tonight, Minnie. I need you to bring me the phone over. Her voice breaks into a trembly wail. Drag it on over and fetch my phone book that's sitting in the kitchen. You sick, Miss Celia? But she doesn't answer, so I go get the book and stretch the phone over to the bathroom door and tap on it. Just leave it there. Miss Celia sounds like she's crying now. I want you to go on home now. But I just got to. I said go home, Minnie. I step back from that closed door. Heat rises up in my face, and it stings. Not because I haven't been yelled at before. I just haven't been yelled at by Miss Celia yet. The next morning, Woody ASAP on Channel 12 is waving his white scaly hands all over the state map. Jackson, Mississippi is frozen like an ice pop. First it rained, then it froze, then anything with more than a half inch extending broke off to the ground by this morning. Tree branches, power lines, porch awnings collapsed like they plumb given up. Outside's been dunked in a shiny clear bucket of shellac. My kids glue their sleepy faces to the radio, and when the box says the roads are frozen and school is closed, they all jump around and whoop and whistle and run outside to look at the ice with nothing on but their long johns. Get back in this house and put some shoes on, I holler out the door. Not one of them does. I call Miss Celia to tell her I can't drive in the ice and to find out if she's got power out there. After she yelled at me like I was a nigger in the road yesterday, you think I wouldn't give a hoot about her. When I call, I hear, "Yellow?" My heart hiccups. Who's this? Who's calling here? Real careful, I hang up that phone. I guess Mr. John is not working today either. I don't know how he made it home with the storm. All I know is, even on a day off, I can't escape the fear of that man. But in 11 days, that's all gonna be over. Most of the town thaws in a day. Miss C is not in bed when I walk in. She's sitting at the white kitchen table staring out the window with an ugly look on her face like her poor fancy life is just too hot a hell to live in. It's the mimosa tree she's eyeing out there. It took the ice pretty hard. Half of the branches broke off, and all the spindly leaves are brown and soggy. Morning, Minnie, she says, not even looking my way. But I just nod. I have nothing to say to her. Not the way she treated me the day before yesterday. We can finally cut that old ugly thing down now, says Miss Celia. Go ahead, cut them all down. Just like me, cut me down for no reason at all. Miss Celia gets up and comes over to the sink where I'm standing. She grabs hold of my arm. I'm sorry I hollered at you like I did. Tears brim up in her eyes when she says it. Mm-hmm. I was sick, and I know that's no excuse, but I was feeling real poor, and she starts sobbing in, like the worst she's ever done in her whole life is yell at her maid. All right, I say. Ain't nothing to boo-hoo over. And then she hugs me tight around the neck until I kind of pat her on the back and peel off. Go on, sit down, I say. I'll fix you some coffee. I guess we all get a little snippy when we're not feeling good. By the next Monday, the leaves on that mimosa tree have turned black, like it burned instead of froze. I come in the kitchen ready to tell her how many days we have left, but Miss Celia's staring at that tree, hating it with her eyes the same way she hates the stove. She's pale, won't eat anything I put in front of her. All day, instead of laying up in bed, she works on decorating the 10-foot Christmas tree in the foyer, making my life a vacuum in hell with all those needles flying around. Then she goes in the backyard, starts clipping the rose bushes and digging the tulip bulbs. I've never seen her move that much, ever. She comes in for her cooking lesson afterward, with dirt under her nails, but she's not smiling. 6 more days before we tell Mr. Johnny, I say. She doesn't say anything for a while. Then a voice comes out as flat as a pan. Are you sure I have to? I was thinking maybe we could wait. I stop where I am with buttermilk dripping off my hands. Ask me how sure I am again. All right, all right. And then she goes outside again to take up her new favorite pastime, staring down that mimosa tree with the axe in her hand. But she never takes a chop. Wednesday night, all I can think is just 96 more hours. Knowing I might not have a job after Christmas gnaws at my stomach. I have a lot more to worry about than just being shot dead. Miss C is supposed to tell him on Christmas Eve after I leave, before they go over to Mr. Johnny's mama's house. But Miss C is acting so strange. I wonder if she's going to try and back out. No, ma'am, I say to myself all day. I intend to stay on her like hair on soap. When I walk in Thursday morning, though, Miss C is not even home. I can't believe she's actually left the house. I sit at the table and pour myself a cup of coffee. I look out at the backyard. It's bright, sunny. That black mimosa tree sure is ugly. I wonder why Mr. Johnny just didn't go ahead and cut that thing down. I lean in a little closer to the windowsill. Well, look at there. Down around the bottom, some green fronds are still hanging on, perking up a little in the sun. That old tree just playing possum. I pull a pad out of my pocketbook where I keep a list of what needs to be tended to. Not for Miss Celia, but my own groceries, Christmas presents, things for my kids. Benny's asthma has gotten a little better, but Leroy came home last night smelling like old crow again. He pushed me hard, and I bumped my thigh on the kitchen table. Comes home like that tonight, I'll fix him a knuckle sandwich for supper. I sigh. 72 more hours, and I'm a free woman. Maybe fired. Maybe dead after Leroy finds out, but free. I try to concentrate on the week. Tomorrow's heavy cooking, and I've got the church supper Saturday night and the service on Sunday. When am I going to clean my own house, wash my own kids' clothes? My oldest girl, Sugar, is 16 and pretty good about keeping things neat, but I like to help her out on the weekends the way my mama never helped me. And Abilene, she called me again last night, asked if I'd help her and Miss Skeeter with the stores. I love Abilene. I do. But I think she's making a king-size mistake trusting a white lady. And I told her, too. She's risking her job, her safety, not to mention why anyone would want to help a friend of Miss Hilly's. Lord, I better get on with my work. I pineapple the ham and get it in the oven. Then I dust the shelves in the hunting room, vacuum the bear while he stares at me like I'm a snack. Just you and me today, I tell him. As usual, he doesn't say much. I get my rag and my oil soap, work my way up the staircase, polishing each spoke on the banister as I go. When I make it to the top, I head into bedroom number one. I clean upstairs for about an hour. It's chilly up here. No bodies to warm it up. I work my arm back and forth across everything wood. Between the second and third bedrooms, I go downstairs to Miss Celia's room before she comes back. I get that eerie prickle of being in a house so empty. Where'd she go? After working here all this time and her only leaving 3 times and always telling me when and where and why she's leaving, like I care anyway, now she's gone like the wind. I ought to be happy. I ought to be glad that fool's out of my hair. But being here by myself, I feel like an intruder. I look down at the little pink rug that covers the blood stain by the bathroom. Today I was going to take another crack at it. A chill blows through the room like a ghost passing by. I shiver. Maybe I won't work on that bloodstain today. On the bed, the covers, as usual, have been thrown off. The sheets are twisted and turned around the wrong way. It always looks like a wrestling match has gone on in here. I stop myself from wondering. You start wondering about people in the bedroom. Before you know it, you're all wrapped up in their business. I strip off one of the pillowcases. Miss C's mascara smudged little charcoal butterflies all over it. The clothes on the floor, I stuff in the pillowcases to make it easier to carry. I pick up Mr. Johnny's folded pants off the yellow ottoman. Now, how am I supposed to know if these is clean or dirty? I stick them in the sack anyway. My motto on housekeeping, when in doubt, wash it out. I tote the bag over to the bureau. The bruise on my thigh burns when I bend down to pick up a pair of Miss Celia's silky stockings. Who are you? I drop the sack. Slowly, I back away until my bottom bumps the bureau. He's standing in the doorway, eyes narrowed. Real slow, I look down at that axe hanging from his hand. Oh, Lord, I can't get to the bathroom because he's too close and he'd get in there with me. I can't make it past him out of the door unless I pummel him. And the man has an axe. My head throbs. I'm so panicked. I'm cornered. Mr. Johnny stares down at me. He swings the axe a little, tilts his head and smiles. I do the only thing I can do. I wrinkle my face as mean as I can, pull my lips across my teeth and yell, "You and your axe better get out of my way!" Mr. Johnny looks down at the axe like he forgot he had it, then back up at me. We stare at each other a second. I don't move and I don't breathe. He sneaks a look over at the sack I've dropped to see what I was stealing. The leg of his khakis is poking out the top. "Now listen," I say, and tears spring up in my eyes. "Mr. Johnny, I told Miss Celia to tell you about me. I must have asked her 1,000 times. But he just laughs. He shakes his head, thinks it's funny he's about to chop me up. "Just listen to me," I told her, but he's still chuckling. "Calm down, girl. I'm not gonna get you," he says. "You surprised me, that's all." I'm panting, easing my way toward the bathroom. He still has that axe in his hand, swinging it a little. "What's your name, anyway?" "Minnie," I whisper. I've still got 5 feet to go. "How long you been coming here, Minnie?" "Not long," I jiggle my head, "no. How long?" "Few weeks," I say, bite down on my lip. 3 months. He shakes his head. "Now I know it's been longer than that." I look at the bathroom door. What good would it do to be in a bathroom where the door won't even lock, when a man's got an axe to hack it down with? "I swear I'm not mad," he says. "What about that axe?" I say, my teeth gritted. He rolls his eyes, then he sets it on the carpet, kicks it to the side. "Come on, let's go have us a talk in the kitchen." He turns and walks away. I look down at the axe, wondering if I should take it. Just the sight of it scares me. I push it under the bed and follow him. In the kitchen, I edge myself close to the back door, check the knob to make sure it's unlocked. "Minnie, I promise, it's fine that you're here," he says. I watch his eyes, trying to see if he's lying. He's a big man, 6'2" at least. A little paunch in the front, but strong looking. "I reckon you're gonna fire me then." "Fire you?" he laughs. "You're the best cook I've ever known. Look what you've done to me." He frowns down at his stomach that's just starting to poke out. "Hell, I haven't eaten like this since Cora Blue was around. She practically raised me." I take a deep breath because his knowing Cora Blue seems to safen things up a little. Her kids went to my church. I knew her. "I sure do miss her." He turns, opens the refrigerator, stares in, closes it. "When see you coming back? You know?" Mr. Johnny asked. "I don't know. I expect you went to get a hair done." I thought for a while there, when we were eating your food, she really did learn how to cook. Until that Saturday when you weren't here and she tried to make hamburgers. He leans against the sink board, sighs. "Why doesn't she want me to know about you?" "I don't know. She won't tell me." He shakes his head, looks up at the black mark on the ceiling from where Miss Celia burned up the turkey that time. Minnie, I don't care if Celia never lifts another finger for the rest of her life. But she says she wants to do things for me herself. He raises his eyebrows a little. I mean, do you understand what I was eating before you got here? She learning. At least she trying to learn. But I kind of snorted this. Some things you just can't lie about. I don't care if she can cook. I just want her here, he shrugs. With me. He rubs his brow with his white shirt sleeve, and I see why his shirt is always so dirty. And he is sort of handsome for a white man. She just doesn't seem happy, he says. Is it me? Is it the house? Are we too far away from town? I don't know, Mr. Johnny. Then what's going on? He props his hand down on the counter behind him, grabs hold. Just tell me, is she... He swallows hard. Is she seeing somebody else? I try not to, but I feel kind of sorry for him, seeing he's just as confused as I am about all this mess. Miss Johnny, this ain't none of my business, but I can tell you, Miss Celia ain't having no relations outside of this house. He nods. You're right. That was a stupid thing to ask. I eye the door, wondering when Miss Celia gonna be home. I don't know what she'd do if she found Mr. Johnny here. Look, he says, don't say anything about meeting me. I'm gonna let her tell me when she's ready. I manage my first real smile. So you want me to just go on like I've been doing? Look after her. I don't like her in this big house by herself. Yes, sir, whatever you say. I came by today to surprise her. I was going to cut down that mimosa tree that she hates so much, then take her into town for lunch, pick out some jewelry for a Christmas present. Mr. Johnny walks to the window, looks out, and sighs. I guess I'll go get lunch in town somewhere. I'll fix you something. What you want? He turns around, grinning like a kid. I start going through the refrigerator, pulling things out. Remember those pork chops we had that time? He starts nibbling on his fingernail. Will you make those for us this week? I'll fix them for supper tonight. Got some in the freezer, and tomorrow night you having chicken and dumplings. Oh, Cora Blue used to make those. Sit up there at the table, and I'm going to do you a good BLT to take with you in the truck. And will you toast the bread? Of course. Can't have no proper sandwich on no raw bread. And this afternoon, I'll make one of Minnie's famous caramel cakes, and next week, we gonna do you a fried catfish. I pull out the bacon for Mr. Johnny's lunch, get the skillet out to fry. Mr. Johnny's eyes are clear and wide. He's smiling with every part of his face. I fix his sandwich and wrap it in wax paper. Finally, somebody I get the satisfaction of feeding. Minnie, I have to ask, if you're here, what in the world is Celia doing all day? I shrug. I ain't never seen a white woman sit there like she do. Most of them is busy, running errands, acting like they busier than me. She needs some friends. I asked my buddy Will if he'd get his wife to come out and teach her to play bridge, get her in a group. I know Hilly's the ringleader of all that stuff. I stare at him. Like if I keep real still, maybe it wouldn't be true. Finally, I ask, that Miss Hilly Holbrook you talking about? You know her? Mm-hmm. I swallow the tire iron that's rising up in my throat at the thought of Miss Hilly hanging around this house. Miss Celia finding out the truth about the terrible awful. There's no way those two could be friends, but I bet Miss Hilly would do anything for Mr. Johnny. I'll call Will tonight and ask him again. He pats me on the shoulder, and I find myself thinking about that word again. Truth. And Abilene's telling Miss Skeeter all about it. If the truth gets out on me, I'm done. I crossed the wrong person, and that's all it takes. I'm going to give you my number at the office. Call me if you ever run into any trouble, all right? Yes, sir. I say, feeling my dread erase any relief I had coming to me today.
Miss Skeeter, Chapter 11. It's technically winter in most of the nation, but already there is gnashing of teeth and wringing of hands in my mother's house. Signs of spring have come too early. Daddy's in a cotton-planting frenzy. Had to hire 10 extra field workers to till and drive tractors to get the seed in the ground. Mother's been studying the farmer's almanac, but she's hardly concerned with planting. She delivers the bad news to me with a hand on her forehead. "They say this'll be the most humid one in years," she sighs. "The shinolator never did much good after those first few times. I'd pick up some more spray cans down at Beeman's. The new extra-heavy kind." She looks up from the almanac, narrows her eyes at me. "What are you dressed that way for?" I have on my darkest dress, dark stockings. The black scarf over my hair probably makes me look more like Peter O'Toole in Lawrence of Arabia than Marlene Dietrich. The ugly red satchel hangs from my shoulder. "I have some errands to run tonight. Then I'm meeting some girls at church." "On a Saturday night? Mama, God doesn't care what day of the week it is," I say and make for the car before she can ask any more questions. Tonight, I'm going to Abilene's for her first interview. My heart racing, I drive fast on the paved town roads, heading for the colored part of town. I've never even sat at the same table with a Negro who wasn't paid to do so. The interview has been delayed by over a month. First, the holidays came, and Abilene had to work late almost every night, wrapping presents and cooking for Elizabeth's Christmas party. In January, I started to panic when Abilene got the flu. I'm afraid I've waited so long, Mrs. Stein will have lost interest or forgotten why she even agreed to read it. I drive the Cadillac through the darkness, turning on Jessam Avenue, Abilene Street. I'd rather be in the old truck, but Mother would have been too suspicious, and Daddy was using it in the fields. I stop in front of an abandoned, haunted-looking house three down from Abilene's, as we planned. The front porch of the spooky house is sagging. The windows have no panes. I step into the dark, lock the doors, and walk quickly. I keep my head lowered, my noisy heels clicking on the pavement. A dog barks, and my keys jangle to the pavement. I glimpse around, pick them up. Two sets of colored people sit on porches, watching, rocking. There are no streetlights, so it's hard to say who else sees me. I keep walking, feeling as obvious as my vehicle, large and white. I reach number 25, Abilene's house. I give one last look around, wishing I wasn't 10 minutes early. The colored part of town seems so far away when evidently it's only a few miles from the white part of town. I knock softly. There are footsteps, and something inside slams closed. Abilene opens the door. "Come on in," she whispers, and quickly shuts it behind me and locks it. I've never seen Abilene in anything but her whites. Tonight she has on a green dress with black piping. I can't help but notice she stands a little taller in her own house. "Make yourself comfortable. I'll be back real quick." Even with the single lamp on, the front room is dark, full of browns and shadows. The curtains are pulled and pinned together so there's no gap. I don't know if they're like that all the time, or just for me. I lower myself onto the narrow sofa. There's a wooden coffee table with hand-tatted lace draped over the top. The floors are bare. I wish I hadn't worn such an expensive-looking dress. A few minutes later, Abilene comes back with a tray holding a teapot and two cups that don't match, paper napkins folded into triangles. I smell the cinnamon cookies she's made. As she pours the tea, the top to the pot rattles. "Sorry," she says, and holds the top down. "I ain't never had a white person in my house before." I smile, even though I know it wasn't meant to be funny. I drink a sip of tea. It is bitter and strong. "Thank you," I say. "The tea is nice." She sits and folds her hands in her lap, looks at me expectantly. "I thought we'd do a little background work and then just jump right in with the questions," I say. I pull out my notebook and scan the questions I've prepared. They suddenly seem obvious, amateur. "All right," she says. She's sitting up very straight on the sofa, turned toward me. "Well, to start, when and where were you born?" She swallows, nods. 1909, Piedmont Plantation down in Cherokee County." "Did you know when you were a girl growing up that one day you'd be a maid?" "Yes, ma'am, yes I did." I smile, wait for her to elucidate. There's nothing. "And you knew that because?" "Mama was a maid. My grandmama was a house slave." "A house slave, uh-huh," I say, but she only nods. Her hands stay folded in her lap. She's watching the words I'm writing on the page. "Did you ever have dreams of being something else?" "No," she says. "No, ma'am, I didn't." It's so quiet, I can hear both of us breathing. "All right, then what does it feel like to raise a white child when your own child's at home being..." I swallow, embarrassed by the question. "Looked after by someone else." "It feel..." She's still sitting up so straight it looks painful. "Maybe we could go on to the next one." "Oh, all right." I stare at my questions. "What do you like best about being a maid, and what do you like least?" She looks up at me, like I've asked her to define a dirty word.
I spec I like looking after the kids best,"
she whispers. "Anything you'd like to add about that?"
"No, ma'am."
"Abilene, you don't have to call me ma'am. Not here."
"Yes, ma'am. Oh, sorry."
She covers her mouth. Loud voices shout in the street and both our eyes dart toward the window. We're quiet. Stock still. What would happen if someone white found out I was here on a Saturday night talking to Abilene in her regular clothes? Would they call the police to report a suspicious meeting? I'm suddenly sure they would. We'd be arrested because that's what they do. They'd charge us with integration violation. I read about it in the paper all the time. They despise the whites that meet with coloreds to help with the civil rights movement. This has nothing to do with integration. But why else would we be meeting? I didn't even bring any Miss Myrna letters as backup. I see open, honest fear on Abilene's face. Slowly, the voices outside dissipate down the road. I exhale, but Abilene stays tense. She keeps her eyes on the curtains. I look down at my list of questions, searching for something to draw this nervousness out of her, out of myself. I keep thinking about how much time I've lost already. "And what did you say you disliked about your job?" Abilene swallows hard. "I mean, do you want to talk about the bathroom? Or about Miss Leafault? Anything about the way she pays you? Has she ever yelled at you in front of Mae Mobley?" Abilene takes a napkin and dabs it to her forehead. She starts to speak, but stops herself. We've talked plenty of times, Abilene. She puts her hand to her mouth. I'm sorry, I... She gets up and walks quickly down the narrow hall. A door closes, rattling the teapot and the cups on the tray. 5 minutes pass. When she comes back, she holds a towel to her front, the way I've seen Mother do after she vomits, when she doesn't make it to her toilet in time. I'm sorry, I thought I was ready to talk. I nod, not sure what to do. I know you already told that lady in New York I's gonna do this, but... She closes her eyes. I'm sorry, I don't think I can. I think I need to lay down. Tomorrow night, I'll come up with a better way. Let's just try again and... She shakes her head, clutches her towel. On my drive home, I want to kick myself for thinking I could just waltz in and demand answers. For thinking she'd stop feeling like the maid just because we were at her house, because she wasn't wearing a uniform. I look over at my notebook on the white leather seat. Besides where she grew up, I've gotten a total of 12 words. And 4 of them are yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. Patsy Cline's voice drifts out of WJDX radio. As I drive down the county road, they're playing Walking After Midnight. When I pull into Hilly's driveway, they're on 3 Cigarettes in an Ashtray. Her plane crashed this morning, and everyone from New York to Mississippi to Seattle is in mourning, singing her songs. I park the Cadillac and stare out at Hilly's rambling white house. It's been 4 days since Abilene vomited in the middle of our interview, and I've heard nothing from her. I go inside. The bridge table is set up in Hilly's antebellum-style parlor with its deafening grandfather clock and gold swag curtains. Everyone is seated. Hilly, Elizabeth, and Luann Templeton, who has replaced Mrs. Walters. Luann is one of those girls who wears a big, eager smile. All the time. And it never stops. It makes me want to stick a straight pin in her. And when you're not looking, she stares at you with that vapid, toothy smile. And she agrees with every single little thing Hilly says. Hilly holds up a Life magazine, points to a spread of a house in California. A den, they're calling it. Like wild animals are living there. Oh, isn't that dreadful? Luann beams. The picture shows wall-to-wall shag carpet and low streamlined sofas, egg-shaped chairs and televisions that look like flying saucers. In Hilly's parlor, a portrait of a Confederate general hangs 8 feet tall. It is as prominent as if he were a grandfather and not a third cousin removed. That's it. Trudy's house looks just like that, Elizabeth says. I've been so wrapped up in the interview with Abilene, I'd almost forgotten Elizabeth's trip last week to see her older sister. Trudy married a banker and they moved to Hollywood. Elizabeth went out there for 4 days to see her new house. Well, that's just bad taste is what it is, Hilly says. No offense to your family, Elizabeth. What was Hollywood like? Luann asks. Oh, it was a dream. And Trudy's house, TV sets in every room. That same crazy space-age furniture you could hardly even sit in. We went to all these fancy restaurants where the movie stars eat and drank martinis and burgundy wine. And one night, Max Factor himself came over to the table, spoke to Trudy like they're just old friends. She shakes her head. Like they were just passing by in the grocery store. Elizabeth sighs. Well, if you ask me, you're still the prettiest in the family, Hilly says. Not that Trudy's unattractive, But you are the one with the poise and the real style.
Elizabeth smiles at this, but then drifts back to frowning.
Not to mention she has live-in help every day, every hour. I hardly had to see Mae Mobley at all.
I cringe at this comment, but no one else seems to notice. Hilly's watching her maid, Yule May, refill our tea glasses. She's tall, slender, almost regal-looking, and has a much better figure than Hilly. Seeing her makes me worry about Abilene. I've called Abilene's house twice this week, but there wasn't any answer. I'm sure she's avoiding me. I guess I'll have to go to Elizabeth's house to talk to her, whether Elizabeth likes it or not.
I was thinking, next year we might do a Gone with the Wind theme for the benefit,
Hilly says. Maybe rent the old Fairview mansion?
What a great idea,
Luann says.
Oh, Skeeter, Hilly says. I know you just hated missing it this year.
I nod, give a pitiful frown. I'd pretended to have the flu to avoid going alone.
I'll tell you one thing, Hilly says. I won't be hiring that rock and roll band again, playing all that fast dance music.
Elizabeth taps my arm. She has her handbag in her lap.
I almost forgot to give this to you. From Abilene, for the Miss Myrna thing. I told her, though, y'all cannot powwow on this today. Not after all that time she missed in January.
I open the folded piece of paper. The words are in blue ink, in a lovely cursive hand. I know how to make the teapot stop rattling.
And who in the world cares about how to make a teapot not rattle? Elizabeth says, because of course she read it.
It takes me 2 seconds and a drink of iced tea to understand. You wouldn't believe how hard it is, I tell her. 2 days later, I sit in my parents' kitchen, waiting for dusk to fall. I give in and light another cigarette, even though last night the Surgeon General came on the television set and shook his finger at everybody, trying to convince us that smoking will kill us. But Mother once told me tongue-kissing would turn me blind, and I'm starting to think it's all just a big plot between the Surgeon General and Mother to make sure no one ever has any fun. At 8 o'clock that same night, I'm stumbling down Abilene's street as discreetly as one can, carrying a 50-pound Corona typewriter. I knock softly, already dying for another cigarette to calm my nerves. Abilene answers and I slip inside. She's wearing the same green dress and stiff black shoes as last time. I try to smile, like I'm confident it will work this time, despite the idea she explained over the phone.
Could we sit in the kitchen this time?
I ask. Would you mind?
All right. Ain't nothing to look at, but come on back.
The kitchen is about half the size of the living room, and warmer. It smells like tea and lemons. The black and white linoleum floor has been scrubbed thin. There's just enough counter for the china tea set. I set the typewriter on a scratched red table under the window. Abilene starts to pour the hot water into the teapot.
Oh, none for me, thanks, I say and reach in my bag. I brought us some Coca-Colas if you want one.
I've tried to come up with ways to make Abilene more comfortable. Number one, don't make her feel like she has to serve me.
Well, ain't that nice? I usually don't take my tea till later anyway.
She brings over an opener and 2 glasses. I drink mine straight from the bottle, and seeing this, she pushes the glasses aside, does the same. I called Abilene after Elizabeth gave me the note, and listened hopefully as Abilene told me her idea. For her to write her own words down and then show me what she's written. I tried to act excited, but I know I'll have to rewrite everything she's written, wasting even more time. I thought it might make it easier if she could see it in typeface instead of me reading it and telling her it can't work this way. We smile at each other. I take a sip of my Coke, smooth my blouse. So, I say. Abilene has a wire-ringed notebook in front of her.
want me to just go ahead and read?
Sure, I say. We both take deep breaths, and she begins reading in a slow, steady voice.
My first white baby to ever look after was named Alton Carrington Spears. It was 1924, and I just turned 15 years old. Alton was a long, skinny baby, with hair fine as silk on a corn.
I begin typing as she reads. Her words rhythmic, pronounced more clearly than her usual talk.
Every window in that filthy house was painted shut on the inside, even though the house was big, with a wide green lawn. I knew the air was bad. Felt sick myself.
Hang on, I say. I've typed wide green. I blow on the typing fluid. Retype it. Okay, go ahead.
When the mama died, 6 months later,
she reads,
of the lung disease, they kept me on to raise Alton until they moved away to Memphis. I loved that baby, and he loved me, and that's when I knew I was good at making children feel proud of themselves.
I hadn't wanted to insult Abilene when she told me her idea. I tried to urge her out of it over the phone. Writing isn't that easy. And you wouldn't have time for this anyway, Abilene, not with a full-time job.
Can't be much different than writing my prayers every night.
It was the first interesting thing she'd told me about herself since we'd started the project. So I'd grabbed the shopping pad in the pantry.
You don't say your prayers, then?
I never told nobody that before. Not even Minnie. Find I can get my point across a lot better writing 'em down.
So this is what you do on the weekends? I asked. In your spare time? I liked the idea of capturing her life outside of work, when she wasn't under the eye of Elizabeth Leafold.
Oh, no. I write an hour. Sometimes two, every day. Lot of ailing, sick peoples in this town.
I was impressed. That was more than I wrote on some days. I told her we'd try it just to get the project going again. Abilene takes a breath, a swallow of Coke, and reads on. She backtracks to her first job at 13, cleaning the Francis I silver service at the governor's mansion. She reads how on her first morning, she made a mistake on the chart where you filled in the number of pieces so they'd know you hadn't stolen anything.
I come home that morning, after I'd been fired, and stood outside my house with my new work shoes on, the shoes my mama paid a month's worth of light bill for. I guess that's when I understood what shame was, and the color of it, too. Shame ain't black, like dirt. Like I always thought it was. Shame be the color of a new white uniform your mother ironed all night to pay for. White, without a smudge or a speck of work dirt on it.
Abilene looks up to see what I think. I stop typing. I'd expected the stories to be sweet, glossy. I realize I might be getting more than I'd bargained for. She reads on.
So I go on and get the shiver robe straightened out, and before I know it, that little white boy done cut his fingers clean off in that window fan I asked her to take out 10 times. I never seen that much red come out a person, and I grabbed the boy. I grabbed them 4 fingers, tote him to the colored hospital 'cause I didn't know where the white one was. But when I got there, a colored man stopped me and say, "Is this boy white?"
The typewriter keys are clacking like hail on a roof. Abilene is reading faster, and I'm ignoring my mistakes, stopping her only to put in another page. Every 8 seconds, I fling the carriage aside.
And I say, "Yes, sir." And he say, "Is them his white fingers?" And I say, "Yes, sir." And he say, Well, you better tell him he your high yellow, 'cause that colored doctor won't operate on a white boy in a Negro hospital. And then, a white policeman grab me and he say, now, you look a here.
She stops, looks up. The clacking ceases. What? The policeman said look a here what?
Well, that's all I put down. Had to catch the bus for work this morning.
I hit the return and the typewriter dings. Abilene and I look each other straight in the eye. I think this might actually work. Chapter 12. Every other night for the next 2 weeks, I tell Mother I'm off to feed the hungry at the Canton Presbyterian Church, where we, fortunately, know not a soul. Of course, she'd rather I go down to the First Presbyterian, but Mother's not one to argue with Christian works, and she nods approvingly, tells me on the side to make sure I wash my hands thoroughly with soap afterward. Hour after hour in Abilene's kitchen, she reads her writing and I type, the details thickening, the baby's faces sliding into focus. At first, I'm disappointed that Abilene is doing most of the writing, with me just editing. But if Mrs. Stein likes it,